Nate, tell me something funny. We need a good cold open.
I can't be spontaneously funny like that. I'm not a comedian.
We got it. That's it. That's a cold open.
Wait, I actually like that. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk. All right. I don't know if we got it, but we gave it the effort.
You know, it's a rainy morning when we're recording this. Nothing but darkness on the horizon. So, you know, maybe a little bit lackluster relative to some previous Model Talk intros.
Well, I was going to say, we have 18 days until Election Day. How are you doing? It sounds like not great.
No, I'm doing okay. It's like Zeno's paradox where each day, each step is like twice as long or something. Yeah, I don't know. There's been on the social media and stuff, like a little bit of relitigation of 2016. Always a fun topic.
You love to see it. Do you feel like the pressure is on this time around in a way that's any different because people had doubts about the forecast in 2016, whether legitimate or illegitimate?
I think, and you can go ahead and, I don't know if you listen to like the Zach Lowe podcast, like about like the aggregators. So if you're an aggregator, I think 538, not only should we not have been blamed, I think we should have gotten a lot of credit for 2016 for being prescient and for giving Trump a pretty good shot when other people didn't.
Well, right. But anybody who listens to this podcast knows that. So I guess I'm curious, does the pressure feel any different this time around? Not because whether or not those criticisms are legitimate, we've said that they aren't, but because of the popular perception of forecasting and polling and things like that.
I mean, it's all fucking stupid. All these models, I mean, there used to be bigger differences now. All these models have Biden at about the same number now, at 87%. The Economist is 91%. One's 88%, 84%. They're all saying, okay, look, we're now at the point where we can go back and examine how big is his lead, how off would polls have to be for Trump to win, right? And it's just, we're just handicapping services. That's the correct number that Trump, just give him a range, somewhere in the range of 5% to 20%, depending on different assumptions, given how far behind he is in the polls, and given that we have 2.5 weeks to go, and accounting for the fact that errors are correlated in different states, and like, we are setting those odds correctly. We do not determine if we're in the 1 in 8 world where he wins the 1 in 8 or 1 in 7 chance. That's not up to us. It's up to voters. It's up to the candidates. Up to the world, right? It's up to the pollsters, I guess, to some extent. But we're setting proper odds. And in a world where people are more rational, then I don't really care if the 1 in 8 comes up or the 7 in 8 comes up. Now, realistically, will I be in a lot of shit? Will the whole polling world be in a lot of shit? Probably, but I fucking don't give a shit. Because, like, I can't do anything about it. And all I can do is give you an honest answer and give you the best forecast that I can. So I can't do anything about it. I'd much rather be on the side where 87% of the time we'll look at least somewhat smart instead of 70%. You know, given that we get shit on, even if, like, we have a narrow favorite who loses, I'd much rather that someone be a heavier favorite. But beyond that, I can't do anything about it.
All right, you heard it here first, folks. According to 538, Nate Silver has exactly zero f's to give if you don't like our forecast.
I mean, what could I do? We spend so much time with these models thinking carefully about different sources of uncertainty and making conservative choices, we think. Not unduly conservative, but understanding that usually when you're back testing a model, you tend to make overly optimistic choices. So when we're kind of making deliberate choices, then we err on the conservative side, right? Donald Trump is 10.5 points behind in national polls, probably 7.5 points behind in the tipping point states. Biden's at 52 or 53% of the vote. There are not very many undecided voters left. 20 million people have already voted as the time we're recording this, right? The race has been pretty stable. Trump is trying the same lines that he has for the whole campaign that have him 10 points down, right? There's a pandemic that's killed how many people now?
215,000 plus.
And it's getting worse again in the U.S. We're not going on a limb, out on a limb, but with a model that says Biden is the heavy favorite. To me, that Trump still has a 1 in 7 or a 1 in 8 chance or whatever is actually kind of high given all the things that are going wrong for him.
All right. So I think it's fair to say that how the public views our work is to some extent out of our control at this point. We try to be really diligent. We try to show our work and explain where we're coming from. And we hope that people appreciate that. But let's check in on specifically where our forecasts stand for the presidency, Senate, House, et cetera. And then we'll get into some more specific questions. So as of the time of this recording, which is Friday morning, as you already mentioned, Nate, Joe Biden has an 87% chance of winning. Democrats have a 73% chance of winning the Senate and a 96% chance of keeping the House. And I also looked this up before we recorded. It's not listed on the forecast, but Democrats have a combined 70% chance of winning all three. So there's a slim chance that Democrats would, I guess, win the Senate, but not the presidency. But in large part, that trifecta hinges on the Senate or vice versa. So let's start by talking about the Senate, which has the most uncertainty involved in the forecast at this point. And Democrats' chances of winning that chamber have gone up by about 10 percentage points in the past 10 days, and they've gone up from about 58% when we launched. So what's responsible for the changes that we're seeing in the Senate?
So one thing to keep in mind with all these forecasts is that Democrats are ahead. And so if time runs off the clock and the situation stays as it was before, then they gain ground because there's less time for Republicans to have something shift that brings the race back toward them. Yeah, with the Senate, it's just a lot of like drip, drip, drip of individual polls and individual states that tend to be fairly good for Democrats. There's been a bunch of polling in North Carolina that tends to show Cal Cunningham, the Democrat, still ahead, despite sexting accusations. Gideon in Maine, the Democrat, is up to 63% to win. Kind of that's a little bit out of the toss-up zone into lean Democratic in Maine. In Georgia, quite a bit of polling there in both those races. Remember, there's a special election race in Georgia that has multiple candidates on the ballot for both parties. What's happened there is that you have two Republicans, Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins, who are kind of trying to outflank one another and be kind of crazy far right. I mean, Kelly Loeffler like was endorsed by a QAnon supporter the other day and proudly bragged about it. Whereas one Democrat, Raphael Warnock, has locked up almost all the Democratic vote. So that's all of a sudden a very competitive race when we play out both the primary and the runoff.
Yeah, I'll say on Georgia, we did have several listeners send us questions about that. Folks noticed that in one day, Republicans went from a 72% chance of holding that seat in the special election to a 51% chance. Was there something specific that happened on that one day?
So it is pretty unusual if you track our models for us to have that sharpest shift. The reason it happened there is that you have all these pollsters that have been conducting polls of Georgia, but they haven't been testing potential runoff matchups. Quinnipiac finally tested Warnock versus Loeffler and Collins one-on-one, and they had Warnock, the Democrat, way ahead. So finally getting runoff polls, and we basically were flying blind, made the model more confident that Democrats could potentially win a runoff there. And since that race is very, very likely to go to a runoff, then that was important to the model.
When considering the likelihood of the Democrat or Republican winning that runoff election in Georgia, it's going to happen in January, and we're already going to know the results of the election. So does that change the probabilities at all once that happens? Is there a different electorate, say, in a special election runoff than there would be in November?
So currently the Democrats have an edge in the generic ballot. They're 6 points ahead, and that's kind of the national environment, is pro-Democratic for races for Congress by 6 points. I believe the model assumes that for the runoff, that it goes back to a neutral environment, or at least an uncertain environment. So it does assume that things are worse for Democrats than they would be if you had that runoff immediately. So it's like Warnock is ahead in the polls of the runoff. Our models prior is probably that Republicans would win the runoff. And it's balancing those two and kind of coming up with 50-50 in Georgia now.
All right. So we were focusing in on the Senate. We've talked about North Carolina and Georgia. Are we seeing any other significant polls coming in, giving us a better picture of how the races are playing out? And maybe starting with Alaska, which plenty of people have asked about and has become somewhat of a meme on Twitter. What's the expression?
Don't sleep on Alaska.
Which I think that election Twitter has been like crowdfunding even polls of Alaska. I don't know what exactly is so exciting about Alaska. I am sure that it's lovely. And obviously it's the largest state in the union. So there's lots to love. But what do we know about the actual Senate race there, or presidential for that matter?
So we will know more after we finish recording this. A New York Times Siena College upshot poll will be available in Alaska.
You mean you don't have the inside scoop?
I don't have the inside scoop. I could ask, Damn. But there hasn't been a lot of high quality polling in Alaska. Number one, the polling in Alaska is always kind of a mess. You do have some partisan polling suggesting that the race is very close, the Senate race there. I'll be curious to see what that New York Times poll shows. But you do have to remember in 2008, a similar year for the top of the ticket presidentially, Democrat Mark Begich won a Senate race in Alaska. And it reminds me just a little bit of this year where Al Gross, Democratic candidate in the polls, is kind of tied now, although it's mostly partisan polls, right? Kind of tied now, maybe a couple of points behind Dan Sullivan, the incumbent. I guess the last nonpartisan poll of Alaska had Sullivan up 4. And if the partisan polls have a tie, then that also would translate into roughly Sullivan plus 4. Alaska's a state where there's a lot of uncertainty. And so it's a race to watch with about a 25% chance of winning pre-upshot Siena poll. And the presidency in Alaska, for that matter, I mean, Biden is doing well, relatively speaking, in a lot of these very northern states, Maine, Minnesota. So we also have Biden with about a 25% chance of winning the presidency in Alaska.
So to follow up, we're going to get to more listener questions later, but we did get a listener question on this, and it's from Dave. He says, Perry wrote an article on the Senate races in Montana, Kansas, and Alaska. Right now, the model is showing Dems at 32%, 26%, and 23% chance of winning those states. Taken together, that's a 61% chance Dems win at least one of those three Senate seats. Is this the proper way to interpret the model, or should we assume they are correlated?
No, because they are correlated. They're not correlated as much as presidential states are. Senate races can operate somewhat independently from one another, but they are correlated for sure. If you look very carefully at like our Senate histogram, the graph is a little asymmetric, meaning there is a tail where the polls underestimate Democrats. They win all these lean Republican races, right? As well as all the toss-ups. And then all of a sudden they're 55 or something Democratic senators, right? So Republicans do need to worry about that. But at the same time, if everything holds and Democrats could lose all those lean R / toss-up races. I mean, Republicans still have a 30% chance, whatever, 25% of keeping the Senate. It's not nothing.
Yeah. All right. So I do want to talk about the presidency, but are there any other Senate polls that have caught your eye since, I guess, Monday before we move on?
Not really. I mean, the thing about Senate races, too, is that the polling tends to be pretty stable and our model is pretty conservative about shifting those races around. You know, you had a poll, for example, in Michigan that showed the Republican John James only 1 point behind from upshot. But then you've had other polls, people are like, oh my gosh, is that race a toss-up now? But since then you've had several other polls showing Gary Peters, a Democratic incumbent, ahead by 6 to 9 points, I should say. So like people don't change their minds in these Senate races as much as like for the presidency. And they don't change for the presidency much either. But you want to take a pretty long-term look at the polls and not expect there to be some type of sharp turning points necessarily.
So when it comes to the presidency, last week on Model Talk, you said that the state polls didn't quite reflect the 10 to 11 point race that we were seeing in national polls. Is that still the case, or have we seen state polls catch up to the national polling since then?
A little bit. I mean, I'd say maybe there's a point's worth of a gap, right? Where it's more like 9 or 10 points if you extrapolate from state poll versus 10 or 11 points in national polls. I think some of the higher quality state polls maybe are more in line with the larger leads for Biden. There's a lot of mediocre Republican-leaning robo polls, Trafalgar, et cetera, that like kind of get thrown in the averages, right? And they tend to sometimes collectively knock Biden down by half a point or a point or something, if there are several of them at any given time. I don't know. But also, 10 or 11 points is pretty gargantuan lead. That's a very big win. So there's some maybe prior by which you'd be skeptical that he's really hit by 10 or 11 points. Wow, that's big, right? But clearly Trump's not in great shape exactly.
Do we have any better sense at this point of what's responsible for this polling high for Biden? Last week we said so many things were happening at once, it's hard to disentangle them. I guess we're a week out from then now, or should we expect that the debate is still having any impact, that COVID-19 is still having any impact? Of course, COVID-19, the pandemic is, but I mean his personal diagnosis.
I mean, we're outside the range where you'd call it a debate bounce. Debate's 2.5 weeks in the past now, right? So you would think that if Biden has realized gains from the debate, then maybe now they're semi-permanent, especially since Biden's number has come up more than Trump's has come down. You've had some undecideds who have now locked in or decided upon Biden. With COVID, it's a little harder to know if the president being out of the hospital will help him. It doesn't seem like it's tightening based on that, but that's a little bit more uncertain. There are a couple other things. Number one is that Joe Biden has a pretty big edge in advertising, especially in swing states. And we think advertising is a little overrated in general. But if Trump is really kind of running out of money, then maybe that helps put some wind in Biden's sails and adds a point or so to his numbers and keeps that debate balance from receding to the mean. Also, we have a lot of people who've already voted. How pollsters handle that is an interesting question. It's possible that pollsters, some people who were deemed to be unlikely voters, now have voted. And when if you say you've already voted, then you get counted as a likely voter who would have been excluded otherwise. So the early voting could have some effects on the polls. Whether pollsters are handling that correctly or not, I am not one to say, or I am one to say, I haven't researched it enough to know. but, you know, but those are some alternative theories for why Biden's kind of held this lead.
You wrote about this week, and it's something that some of our listeners noted as well, which is that for the first time on our winding path towards an Electoral College victory snake on the forecast, Georgia shaded blue for the first time, which doesn't mean that it's now likely to be won by Biden. It's still essentially a toss-up, but that for the first time in the forecast, the Democrat Biden was slightly ahead of Trump there. Maybe the specific question here we get from Joseph, which is, how surprising is it that Georgia now seems likelier to go blue than Ohio?
I don't know. I mean, we have them kind of the same, right? They're both like as close to 50-50 as it gets. I think I would bet on Ohio if I had to pick between one of those two going to Biden. It's a bit more consistent with his strength elsewhere in the Midwest. There are barriers to vote in Georgia that our model actually does try to kind of account for. But I don't know. I mean, Clinton only lost Georgia by 5 points in 2016. If you only lose by five in an election where you won the popular vote by two, and then Biden wins the popular vote by 10, then you might expect Georgia to shift enough for Biden to win it by a couple of points. So it's not implausible by any means. Georgia's also a pretty inelastic state, meaning it doesn't actually swing around that much, in part because you have like a very solid base of Republican, conservative, evangelical white voters. You have a very solid Democratic base of black voters, plus Atlanta area multicultural younger voters. But the GOP base is just slightly larger. But there probably are enough swing voters in the Atlanta suburbs to hand Democrats narrow victories if Democrats are at the top of the range with those voters. So it's plausible.
And it's worth saying that Trump won Ohio by 8 points in 2016. So actually, Trump did better in Ohio than he did in Georgia. Maybe these are two good states to watch in terms of how Biden and Trump are performing in your perhaps standard Rust Belt versus standard Sun Belt state on Election Day. And it's also worth noting that Democrats don't actually have to win either Georgia or Ohio to win the presidency at all, right?
They do not have to win either state, no. And it's pretty unlikely that either state would be the tipping point. You have to get into some weird maps, right? Where like if Biden loses Nevada and Arizona and Florida and North Carolina, then you have some maps where Biden would need Ohio as part of a strength in the Midwest to overcome losing Nevada and other stuff like that. And similarly, like if Biden got decimated in the Midwest and lost Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Minnesota, then you could make up for that if you won Florida and Georgia and North Carolina. So we're talking about some pretty far-fetched possibilities. Although keep in mind that, like, you know, to some extent now, if Trump is down to a 13-whatever% chance of winning, then weird things would have to happen for Trump to win. You would have to see some big shifts or for the polls to be way off for Trump to win. And if there are big shifts or there's a big polling error, it may not be uniform. It may be that in certain states, something happens to Biden's numbers. Although I would say, by the way, like probably the state that's like the worst affected by COVID right now, or one of the states, is Wisconsin, which is not good timing for the president.
Yeah, which was actually a listener question that we got. So let's dig into a bunch of our listener questions. We got a question from Sam, and it's, how have the recent rises in coronavirus cases affected the model's COVID adjustments? I know that there are not big adjustments based on COVID in the forecast, but to what extent are there? Have they changed anything? And then also, are we seeing it in the polling, I guess, if it's not in the forecast?
So the model's doing some of this work in the background. It tries to figure out if you put an index of COVID severity in a regression analysis, does it give you additional power to explain what the polling says?
But do we see polling shifts in the immediate aftermath of a hotspot in a particular state?
I have not looked at that in detail. I mean, the best example might be something like Florida, where Biden was polling very well in June in the midst of their COVID peak, and then the race tightened a bit after their peak declined. So there's probably some anecdotal evidence for it, but I think we're talking maybe a point or something. I mean, look, I would say the voters are not inclined to vote for President Trump as a result of his COVID handling. There's going to be a lot of news and conversations about rising case counts, about lockdowns. We learned this morning that it's very unlikely that a major U.S. company will seek to get FDA approval for emergency use before the election. Pfizer said today, we're going to wait until mid-November. Other companies have said that too, and or their trials are behind schedule or on pause temporarily anyway. So the fact that we're not in an ebb in COVID cases heading into November 3rd is not favorable for the president.
And it's worth saying, we actually have the numbers still. We're aggregating all of the polling on approval of President Trump's response to the coronavirus crisis. And he's at about negative 18 net approval right now. I think the worst he got was negative 20. The best he got was negative 16 over the past several months. So across the board, Americans aren't happy. The next question we got is a question we got from a lot of people and is also something that the media has been trying to explain recently. The question is, what's behind the GOP's recent new voter registration advantage and what should we make of it for the election?
I think there are a few things. One is that the GOP has been doing more in-person voter registration efforts, door knocking and whatnot, that Democrats had not done until recently. Two is that Democrats had a competitive primary, so they registered a lot of voters late last year or earlier this year. Three is that a lot of younger voters tend not to want to affiliate themselves with the party, so they register as independents, but they probably profile as likely Democratic voters. They might be younger Hispanics, for example, might tend to register as independent, but probably will not vote for Trump. At least most of them won't. So it's not clear that this GOP advantage in party ID necessarily translates one-to-one into actually having more Trump voters, especially because we know that the pool of independent voters, like Biden is winning among independents by 20 points in some polls. It's a really big edge. And the whole shy Trump voter theory that polls are, I mean, there are various versions that are more and less sophisticated. But one version is that polls undersample Republicans, and therefore they underestimate Trump. In fact, a lot of the high-quality polls show Republicans in a good position in party identification, where they're almost tied with Democrats or have closed the gap. And despite that, Trump is losing by 10 points because Biden's winning independents by 20 points. So that really tells a persuasion story. Also, when you ask people, who'd you vote for in 2016? The upshot polls do this. They will find people that say, I voted for Trump in 2016, and this year I'm voting for Joe Biden. You're not a shy Trump voter if you say, I voted for Trump in 2016, but not this year. Or to say, I voted for Gary Johnson in 2016 and voting for Biden this year, or Jill Stein even. So there's all types of evidence that Biden is about persuasion and not turnout, which to me is actually a bit more robust to avoid polling error because turnout can be harder to estimate. You know what I mean? But if you have evidence of vote switchers, then that's usually pretty solid.
Our next question is more of a process question, and it is new polling data manually input into the model, or does the system automatically pull data as it's released?
There are a handful of scrapers for some polls, but generally speaking, we enter stuff in manually.
Shout out to our colleagues who do a hell of a job.
It's a lot of work. And, you know, we're kind of now the de facto polling collector for the whole industry. And we try to be the most comprehensive of anybody. You know, if you're curious, it currently takes about 10 minutes to run 40,000 simulations of the presidential model and about 17 minutes to run 40,000 simulations of the midterm model or the congressional model. The congressional model actually is more code, is more complicated, does more things. So when you see a new poll pop up in our list of polls at 1 p.m., say, and you'd expect at about 1:10 or 1:15, the presidential model would update, and then 1:15 or 1:20, the congressional model would update.
Next question. While early voting isn't an indicator of final results, Will late-breaking events, like a Comey letter, have less impact than they would in a normal, non-pandemic voting environment because so many voters are getting baked in early?
I mean, a bit, right? The question is how much? Because usually people who vote early are weighted toward people who are pretty firm partisans and have kind of decided who they're going to vote on. So let's say that 40% of people have already voted, then a big event happens that shifts things back to Trump. Would that mean it only has 60% of the impact? I'd say probably not, but maybe it would only have 80% as much impact. And so it does provide some insulation to Biden. Look, there is no world in which it's good for Trump that Biden is banking a bunch of votes when he's ahead 10 points. There's no world in which that's good for Trump unless there's some huge rejection rate among these ballots. It may not be that bad for him though, but you know, I mean, in the event of a Comey letter, I mean, maybe because that was Trump won by such a narrow margin in the swing states, maybe a Comey letter in 2020, if that comes at a point when 40 or 50 million people have voted, maybe a third of the overall turnout, right? Maybe that would be just enough to have saved Clinton in 2016, maybe.
Katie asks, you've mentioned numerous times that the model assumes tightening in the polls. When does that assumption go away and the model just uses the polls? Is that only on election day or someday prior to then?
I think it's actually the day before the election. The economic weight goes to zero. Let me look up for people kind of where we have this now. It's currently 91% polls and 9% are prior. So the prior doesn't play a huge role, but it does a little bit. So it means that as of this recording, we have Biden projected to win by 8.3 points. So note that that assumes some tightening. Without the prior, he'd be ahead by 9.1 points. So why 9.1 and not 10.5 or whatever he is in national polls? Well, again, that gets back to that state poll versus national poll gap. Our forecast of the popular vote is mostly based on state polls, and they're more consistent with like a 9 or 9.5 point Biden lead.
We got a question from Ariel who says, what are the percentage point ranges you use for the different levels of certainty on the website? And Ariel's referring to the favored, slightly favored, clearly favored demarcation that we assign to certain percent chances. I actually have the list in front of me, so I can clarify that for Ariel. So from 50 to 54% chance, we say it's a toss-up. From 55 to 69, we say slightly favored. From 70 to 89% chance, we say favored. So that's where we are right now for Joe Biden. For clearly favored, the next indication that we have not actually gotten to yet, it's 90% to 97%. And then 98 or above is very likely to win the election. So Nate, do you think we're going to get to either clearly favored or very likely to win the election in the next 2.5 weeks?
I mean, so Biden will keep gaining if the polls hold steady in the percentage terms, right? Because it means there's less time for Trump to make up ground. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in theory, in a well-calibrated forecast, then the percentage that you have in any given day is also the best prediction of the percentage that you have the next day. So in theory, you would predict that Biden will stay at 87% because the race would tighten a little bit. You know, in practice, I don't know. I mean, in practice, we can get into questions of what could Trump do to help facilitate a comeback. Again, I get back to like 10.5 points is such a big lead relative to even where this campaign has been, even relative to 2008 with Obama, where he won by 7. 10.5 is such a big lead that, like, I don't know if that's easy to sustain. Although who knows, you know, maybe Trump is in a proverbial downward spiral. I don't know. That's plausible too. But the model, look, we go with our forecast. Our forecast says that Biden's going to win the popular vote by 8, 8.5 points and not 10.5 points. So it does kind of assume the race would tighten a bit.
We've got this question a couple times, and it's which party is favored to control the most state delegations in the House? People are asking this question because if there's a tie in the Electoral College, it goes to the House, and then the votes are cast according to state delegation majority, not based on individual House members. So essentially the question is, are Democrats or Republicans controlling 6+ state delegations? And I should say there's a less than 1% chance of a tie in the Electoral College according to our forecast right now. But do we have an answer to this question regardless, Nate?
We do. So we currently show a 25% chance that Democrats control the most delegations, a 25% chance that Republicans control the most delegations, and a 50% chance that there's no majority, that no one has 26. It's actually gone up for Democrats. So right now, I think Democrats, Republicans control 26, right? So Democrats have to win back some delegations. The easiest way to do that would be to win the Senate races or the House races in Alaska or Montana, which are competitive and when there's just one seat. So Democrats have gained in this calculation, it looks like, a bit. But keep in mind that, like, this is conditional in a world where Trump is having a really bad night and loses the popular vote by 8 or 9 points, right, and whatnot. If the race tightens, which is a scenario under which the delegations becomes relevant, right, if you have an Electoral College deadlock and you need the House to break a tie or interpret competing slates of electors, then you have a vote by delegations. If we have a tie, that probably means that we've wound up having a much more Republican night than we expected going in. So conditional on the scenario where the delegations matter, then Republicans would probably still have an edge. But, you know, but it's a reason to watch Alaska and Montana. And if you go to download the data, if you go to the House National Top Lines file, it now contains data on the projected number of delegations per party.
All right. We just got a couple more questions. And I should say we got, again, hundreds of listener questions. So thanks to everyone who sent them in. We try to get to as many as possible. A lot of these have longer answers. The question is, what impact does Maine adopting ranked choice voting have on the model, both for the presidency and for Congress?
So it doesn't have much effect. A lot of polls in Maine will use a version where they kind of either simulate the ranked choice themselves or just ask people who would they vote for in a two-way race. So we use that version of the questions in Maine where they're testing basically a two-way matchup instead of with third parties included. We have some code. If you had a case where, like, it was actually unclear who the top two candidates would be, like if an independent, it was a true three-way race, right? We have some code to handle those things, but it's very, very unlikely that you're going to have a third party actually in the top two in any of the main races. So therefore, we basically just use kind of head-to-head polls in Maine to simulate the effect of reallocation of votes.
All right. Sam asks, have you ever considered trying to model how soon we will know the winner of the election? There are so many variables in that question that I can't even imagine trying to begin forecasting it.
We have thought about, like, you know, there are certain states that are thought to be kind of quick counting states, you know, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, right? We thought about, like, can you designate a set of quick counting states? And we might add something on that. I'm not sure there are going to be quite as many bright lines necessarily between fast and slow states as people would want, but we're thinking about trying to have versions of that calculation.
All right, last question, bonus question. Do you have a drink of choice for getting through election night?
Through election night itself? Well, I have to work, so I can't be drinking the booze that I would want.
Well, I feel like it's a getting through election night, it's like coffee or Red Bull. Getting to sleep on election night, it's like whiskey, vodka. Are you a beer guy, a wine guy, or a liquor guy getting to sleep after a wild election night?
I mean, usually I'm a beer guy, but after an election, I'd probably be whiskey or something. Yeah.
All right. That's a good note to end on. Thanks, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
And I should also mention, big news, we are going to be doing daily podcasts basically from here on out, excluding the weekends for the most part. Maybe if something happens, we'll have a weekend podcast. But essentially, from next Monday, when we have our regular Monday podcast, through Election Day, you're going to be getting podcasts every weekday. And then, of course, perhaps some on the weekends. We'll see. Hopefully not. But get ready for daily podcasts. Lots of content.
Daily podcasts, folks. Suffer through these final weeks with us.
There we go. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bittigary Curtis is on audio editing. You can get in touch with us by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Make sure to subscribe on YouTube as well. As you may know, this episode of Model Talk, along with most of the podcasts we do, are also on YouTube. If you would like to watch us from, I guess for me, it's my bedroom. Nate, for you, it's your library. Talk about all of this fun stuff. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.